Light trees.
There you have a very interesting pairing on a song originally composed by the great Bob Marley, and we have his stand-in here, Monty Alexander, a pianist from Jamaica who blends reggae rhythms with jazz, and we have Delfeo Marsalis of the great Marsalis Jazz Dynasty on trombone with No More Trouble. This is from Alexander's 2006 album, Concrete Jungle, the music of Bob Marley. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we keep moving forward. What I wanted to start out with is, what constitutes an apology? Why would a person need to apologize? And how could you tell whether an apology is effective or not? I ask the question because Elizabeth Warren, who, as you know, is a presidential contender in the Democratic Party, and who is pulling some very, very respectable numbers, has been apologizing in a kind of second round of apology to the Cherokee Nation. And practically anybody else who would listen, she's apologizing for basically insulting, as it is widely seen, insulting the Cherokee Nation, and matters relating to Cherokee identity. As you may recall, President, the guy in the White House had at one point, he still does it, calls her very derogatorily Pocahontas, to make fun of the fact that she at one point had claimed a Cherokee identity, and it turned out she decided to prove her Cherokee identity, which she says was the result of her grandmother's family stories, that somehow within their family there was a kind of connection to the Cherokee Nation. She had listed herself as a minority person when she was going to college on the basis of that claim. But in terms of building her career in politics, this was one of the things that she touted in order to make clear to potential voters that while she looked white, totally white, as I would put it that way, she had connections through her forebears to the Cherokee Nation. And that was the first part of the insult. Because anybody who knows anything about First Nations, a piece of paper that, says you are 1/64th Cherokee, or whatever it is that you wish to be identified with, that you do it through some kind of DNA analysis, or that is so totally frowned upon because that's not the way they do it. You have to have pedigree, and you have to prove pedigree. They don't care about what the DNA shows. DNA analysis means nothing because they've had their own way of keeping track. Most of the First Nations, that's how they operate. You just can't walk up and say, well, my great 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 grandmother was Cherokee, okay? What band is she from? Who could you name? Who could you tell us? And they will know within a blink of an eye whether you are a genuine article or not. So she was caught on that, and this was a major offense. Apart from making this claim, which was later found to be not even worth considering, the idea that you believe that you prove your ancestry by going to get a DNA analysis, which none of the nations use. They have documents, they have ways of tracing your lineage, and they couldn't find hers. So she got into a snag with that. So now she is on her second leg. She immediately apologized when the DNA thing exploded and embarrassed her because A, she should have known how the Cherokee Nation proves your lineage, which is not DNA. They don't do DNA. They have records. They have ways of telling who you are through the lineage records that they keep. Okay. And it's not working. So she is on her second round. Presumably, they're not so convinced that Warren has done enough of a job, a good enough job, in laying the matter to rest. So she's making the second round. She's visiting many Native American communities and making herself appear very sympathetic. But essentially, what she's trying to do, and let's not evade it, she is hoping to get political support from the First Nations people. She is setting a kind of precedent in the meantime of being very active in this regard. She is going to these communities. But I'm not buying her apology. So now you're going to tell me why. Why am I skeptical that these are real apologies? What's missing? Do you know? 888-874-4888. What is the matter with Elizabeth Warren's apology? Apologies. What's wrong with them? And why should we, you hear them, but don't hear them too well, because there's something very essential, very vital missing from these apologies. Do you have any idea what it might be? Okay, if you're not fast enough today, fast on the response, I'll keep going. But I wanted to point it out because it is precisely the way progressives, many progressives, behave. But they have the attitude of reactionary people, of colonial mentalities. Okay, so I'll answer the question. If you are apologizing and you're saying things like, I apologize for the hurt I have caused. I apologize for the problems that I have caused with this, what turned out to be a false claim of my lineage. And I'm sorry. That is not an apology. An apology is when you return to the wrong that you have done and you explain in minute detail how you have come to understand it's wrong. Not just, you don't make a blanket statement and say, well, I'm sorry. No, that's not an apology. Sorry, I reject it. A genuine apology would be Elizabeth Warren using herself as an example of white supremacy in this country. We've talked about white supremacy now. Don't tell me you don't understand it. We spent some serious time with the subject. But she cannot and will not claim it. And that would have been a splendid example of an apology, where you return to your wrongdoing. You disassemble it so that everybody could understand it. And then you say you have learned, you have come to a new understanding, and the new understanding is such and such and such. So I understand why I was wrong in the initial stage to do what I did, which was to use identity as a crutch to get me where I wanted to go in this society. And it was a convenient crutch for me to use to propel myself forward. It was very practical to me. And now I understand it even more because it is the very essence of white supremacy. You, for convenience sake, you touted your credentials as part of an oppressed group in this nation because you saw an advantage, a tactical advantage to you personally. You didn't live on reservations, you didn't have to put up with massive unemployment and lack of services and deprivation. You didn't have to do that because you could jump right back into your white world where you enjoyed all these things. You didn't complain because you knew you, as a white woman, even if you claim some affinity with a historically oppressed group, you knew you had the advantage of switching back into the white world where you would be accepted as a full-blooded white woman, entitled to all the rights and privileges. Because you got caught, and at a peculiar time, an inconvenient time, you're running for president. We don't need this kind of hassle. And you're caught in a bind because you have no real defense. So you blame it on your grandmother who told you stories that you have some Cherokee blood in you somewhere, nobody quantifies it, and blah, blah, blah. And then you're caught again. The people you thought were very simple to fool have a very sophisticated way of accounting for who is who. You weren't prepared for that, but they caught you. And now that they are allowing you to come back to clean up yourself, they're allowing you to do that. How generous of them. How forgiving. To receive you in that way. And to give you some latitude in this process of cleaning up your mess and sinking any chance you might have had at the presidency of the United States. But you will not, under any circumstances, open your heart and openly confess what, in fact, you understand as your problem, as the commission of a very bad deed. And in the context I'm talking about, which is white supremacy, because this is what it is. And as a progressive, and she touts her progressive credentials, she is not about to betray it by telling the truth of what she should say, which would have been, to me, a real apology. I did such and such. I lied about my heritage because it was convenient and because I could wiggle my way up the ladder as a different white woman, eschewing the privileges, the automatic privileges of my white skin. I did these things because they were convenient for my personal agenda. I have come to see how wrong it was for me to do this. But she never, never brings it back to her as a fault, as in fact, a very clear demonstration of what white supremacy really is. All right. So when people say they're sorry, I just want to let you know how you know whether they're truly sorry and whether they're asking for forgiveness or they want you to truly understand how they see the breach of honor and what they are prepared to do to mend their ways. They have to confess the sin. That's right. They have to claim it because it was a conscious act and it was predicated on what? Personal agendas. Until you do that, Elizabeth Warren, I consider you as an unapologetic person still playing games with our minds. Still making it look like you're apologizing. You're not apologizing. And you know it. So go away. Go away and let us, and leave us alone. Leave those of us alone who understand exactly what you're doing. And we see that it's yielding results. She's reaching out to more and more Native American communities to impress them as to how different she is. She's not different. She just wants to be seen as such. But make no mistake, she is being very ruthless and very dishonest. Let's move on. You know, when you see these things, you have to point them out because a lot of people miss the subtleties of things. And it's in those subtleties that you find the true person, the true intention. She hasn't come anywhere close to explaining what she understands her commission was. She hasn't let us in on why she chose to lie, why she chose to misrepresent, why she's now choosing to blame Grandma, why she didn't understand or know how Native communities establish and verify your lineage. You can't come into a Cherokee Nation and start talking like, well, my great-granddaddy and my great-grandmammy. No, no, no. Show us your credentials. You have no credentials. You're a fraud. And even when you have the opportunity to correct the situation, to correct it, that is where you would have gotten unending praise and admiration. But that's not in your heart. You're playing by white supremacist rules, and you will lose every time. Which brings me, of course, to Donald Trump and this vendetta that he has against Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, Omar being from Minnesota, Congresswoman from Minnesota, and Rashida Tlaib from Michigan. There is a mismatch of power, and there's a reason to worry about it. I know that the tendency is to root for the underdog. I myself am a professed underdog rooter. I root for underdogs all the time. But if you've been listening to this program, and I've commented about it several times, that there were clear suggestions, clear indications that these two congresswomen, women in particular, more so Ilhan Omar than Rashida Tlaib, I was concerned about who is giving them advice. Where are they getting their ideas from? And have they proceeded being newly elected members of Congress, the first Muslim women? Ilhan Omar is Somali, and Rashida Tlaib was born in the United States of Palestinian parentage. Okay. Now, they're talking about Well, they wanted to go on a fact-finding mission in Israel and were denied entry to Israel, both of them. Trump changed his mind, but only about one of them, and that's Tlaib. Ilhan Omar, the status was that's it. Even as a member of Congress, she was not to be permitted to go to Israel for whatever reason. She was not to be permitted. Now, they're both saying that this is the work, part of the work that they are doing as members of the Foreign Relations Committee. And they're going to see for themselves what is the state of affairs with Palestinians living in occupied territory. Okay. Besides that, according to Tlaib, she had a personal reason for wanting to go. It's been too many years that she's been separated from her grandmother, and she thought this would be also an opportune time to pay her grandmother a visit. All right, let's be real. This is not about doing a trip to look at refugees and people who are living under intolerable circumstances in Palestine, although Israel still insists Palestine does not exist, when we know, even those of you familiar with the Bible, Palestine has always been. And Israel is in Palestine, not the other way around. Okay. Problems. Again, problems. I had been openly critical of Ilhan Omar, because even before she got to Congress, she was running her mouth, just setting fires all over the place on essentially the theme of Israeli dominance and Israeli breaking the laws of the world, universal laws, and the treatment accorded non-Israelis, all non-Israelis, but especially Palestinians, the occupation of their land, and so forth. I get that. I get that she is an advocate of that, of the BDS movement, the boycott, divest, and S stands for what? Oh, I'll get it in a minute. It went right out of my head. It just went out of my head again. But the world has a movement in which they are trying through legal means to encourage other nations in the world to denounce Israeli occupation of Palestine. And more nations are joining with this. And as the movement builds, so does Benjamin Netanyahu's resistance to it. And he is coming down with crushing blows against Palestinians and others in Palestine. I'll still call it Palestine. That's what I have been calling it all these years. And I'm not aware that Palestine ceases to exist simply because a person who considers himself the permanent leader, we have one of those, Donald Trump, calls it whatever it is he wants to call it, and so it is. But I'm coming back now to these two congresswomen. So now Rashida Tlaib says she's no longer interested in going on this mission. And she says that she was actually inspired by her grandmother, who told her, there's no point in coming to see me, and don't fret about it. Don't come. Okay. There are several layers of meaning there. And Ilhan Omar, who at one point there was a relenting, and they said, okay, you could come. This is a member of Congress now, a duly elected member of Congress. Whatever you feel about her, she's an elected member of Congress. She sits on the Foreign Relations Committee. Okay. But she too has turned it down. She's not going. My concerns are not so much about Netanyahu and the Israeli government and supporters of the Israeli government, which include this nation and its president. Netanyahu and Trump almost exactly mirror each other in so many critical areas, militaristic. They're bent on war. There's no end in sight about the wars that they want to wage, the places they want to conquer, the people they want to conquer, and frankly, the people they would like to obliterate, just get rid of them. For Trump, as we see on the border, it's about getting rid of Mexicans. In his head, Mexicans are polluting and diluting the good old American strength. And that was what fueled these last few mass killings we have seen within our borders. And just, I think yesterday, they rounded up three to four more supposed mass killers in the making, where they were plotting to stage even more mass killings in the United States. So I think we're sufficiently aware of the environment that we're living in. But I'm troubled by Omar and Tlaib. I don't know who is advising them, But I see a clear breach between these two particularly and other members of Congress, that one would assume they would have some kind of an ongoing relationship. More so than Tlaib, Omar has fixated on many issues relating to Israel and the Muslim world. And that is a problem. From a tactical point of view, you're leaving yourself open. Were you elected to be the representative of the Muslim world? Or were you elected to represent your district in Minnesota? A fair question. And I am not falling for that idea of this phony notion of nationalism. We've had Muslims in Congress long before they arrived, who were doing the business of their districts. I agree. The time has come for greater solidarity. But we had a president, Barack Obama, who he just set that aside as if the Muslim world does not exist, the Arab world does not exist, the African world does not exist. His sights were set on other things where he felt he was going to get a better yield for his what do you call it? His loyalty, and certainly a better personal yield. Because after the presidency, as you see with the Clintons and others, everybody has a way of making a very lucrative living. But let me come back to Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. You have to admit that your passions do exist and they are intense. And so, in the same way you feel that passion, many others do. Many people feel a great passion about what US involvement in the Arab world has yielded: misery, death, lack of services, the forfeiture of a future for millions and millions of people. I get it that you are passionate. I'm passionate about it. I don't think that the United States, the conduct of the United States on the world stage, is anything to be proud of. But at the same time, don't bamboozle me or attempt to. Don't tell me that this is about looking at things from a foreign relations committee point of view. You have personal reasons. And again, we don't know who is advising you. But it seems as if that part of the world is occupying an inordinate portion of your time and your agenda. I would accept that even if you were open and honest about it. Don't tell me you want to go see your grandmother. Tell me what you want to do, what the intention was. Who is supporting this in Congress? Who are you talking to? What kind of legislation are you thinking of formulating? What kind of action are you urging that the United States and the people of the United States take? You see, there's some fundamental dishonesty here. And in the end, it has the same feel of being played. I don't like to feel played. And certainly in the case of Ilhan Omar, and I commented on it, don't tell me I didn't. As I said many times, it sounded like her brain was in neutral and her mouth was in overdrive, causing all kinds of frictions and causing all kinds of conflagrations and creating a sense that somebody or some group was dominating her legislative agenda. The people of Minnesota elected you. In the case of Tlaib, the people of Michigan elected you. How is it that since you went to Congress, all we are hearing from you is about issues that affect a population or country that isn't anywhere close to either Minnesota or Michigan? Something is happening here. Something is happening here. And it comes off as if you're not letting us in on the secret. You have an agenda, but you're not telling anybody what it is. But you're using their numbers, you're using their political clout, and you're also showing that you're not joining the Congressional Black Caucus. You're not active. You're not part of it. You're separate. It's not them, it's you. So what is going on? I'm not buying the idea. You know, Trump has said this tacky self that Rashida Tlaib had broken down at a news conference that she was giving when she started talking about wanting to see her grandmother and so forth. And he says, I'm not buying her tears. Well, you know, Trump is a tacky, hateful man. So I give him no particular, he gets no consideration from me. I don't regard him as a human being. He's something else, but not a human being. But I'm questioning the actions of Ilhan Omar again and Rashida Tlaib, who I had criticized for her language immediately after she was elected. She said, in front of her children, now let's go impeach this MF-er. And I thought that that was just so wrong in so many ways to behave that way. And that brings me back to you don't see a conscious effort to convey to people that they're thinking and they understand the implications of their actions. You see the hands-off position of the Congressional Black Caucus in particular, and you wonder what is accounting for this breach or this apparent breach? What is accounting for this distance? You look at the initiatives, especially on the part of Omar, you look at the initiatives that she has concerned herself with, and there are questions immediately. There are questions. Number one is who is advising you? What are they advising you to do? How does it pertain to struggles here? And I get the feeling we're not going to get answers anytime soon. But one keeps hoping. Here's what I'll do. I'll stop here for a minute and take your questions and comments at 888-874-4888. I'm not nearly going to get through my whole list here, but this is normal. But we'll catch up because these topics are very much worth discussing. So let's take this short break, and we have a few minutes that we can, in fact, let's not take a break. Let's go straight to your questions if you have any or comments at 888-874-4888 to maximize the time that you could have to have your two cents to contribute to the topic so far. 888-874-4888. So let's see if anybody else is on. Okay. We'll await your questions. As soon as they come in, I'll take them so that again we don't waste any time. 888-874-4888. I want to say this not just to pat myself or to pat ourselves on our backs, but just today in the newspaper, I saw a headline on the very topics we've been discussing, not nearly as deep in the way we've been discussing it, but it means that we're on track. We are on track in discussing these issues, and more so in the way that we're discussing these issues. We are ahead. We are ahead of many of the news organizations. Okay, I don't see any calls just yet, so we'll take a break, a short break. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm your Trice Lead. We've discussed two issues so far today. We've talked about the non-apology, which is being touted as an apology by Elizabeth Warren. Her attempt to assuage the memory of people who know better. And we're talking also about the war between Trump and two members of Congress in particular, Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan. And the issue being Trump boring down on Prime Minister Netanyahu to refuse entry into Israel, into the country, by these two legislators who are members of the Foreign Relations Committee, who wanted for themselves, at least this is what they said, they wanted to go to Israel to see for themselves the conditions under which people living in the occupied territories are living. And of course, the implication is they were going to come back and talk about it and move legislatively on what they saw. I'm having some concerns, and I wish they would do something about it to indicate to us where they're headed, what they're about. And I see a cleavage within the legislative body that I would expect that they would be naturally affiliated with and have an affinity to, and that is a Congressional Black Caucus. But I don't see much of a connection there, and I'm wondering why. I'm wondering why it is that there is no shared agenda. At least this is the way it seems. Now, I could be very wrong on these issues, but I don't see a clear shared agenda. And it's unfortunate because that's what we ought to see. We ought to see something that tells us they're working together. Leona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Greetings, Eutrice. Thank you for taking my
Hello.
call, and hi, and thank you for bringing up the question. I don't live in Tlaib's district. However, I know well, I was in the grocery store the other day, and her picture in the news conference was all over all the TVs. It was a warehouse store anyway, and I'm trying to figure out too what's going on and why is it going on. You know, just as an aside. Now, mind you, recently, I think Rashida Tlaib, in that recent press conference she had with the congresswoman from Minnesota, Tlaib talked about Charles Diggs. She brought up Charles Diggs, former Michigan Congressman Charles Diggs, who in 1972 was, I think, banned or something from going to South Africa because of, So I guess what I'm what if that her bringing him up and what he did in 1972 called to mind what the other thing that Charles Diggs did in 1972. He was a co-convener of the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. The 13th District is predominantly black, last I checked. And I'm wondering if what popped to my mind was that I hope that folks remember that part of Charles Diggs, too, that in 1972 he was busy working on a national black political convention, trying to build a for real black agenda for black people in this country. I guess all I had was a comment. Sorry, I don't have a question, but I appreciate you raising the question about who's advising these two women. Recently, there was an article on this newspaper local in Detroit by a guy named Greg Bowens called, and his quote called, "Rashida Tlaib's Black Problem." And then she responded to it in the same news article, saying, "I won't stop speaking the truth." Rashida Tlaib reacts to Deadline Detroit's column. I guess I don't have anything more to add to the mix, except that I'm glad that you brought it up, and I felt compelled to kind of call, because I was wondering, too, why are they getting all this press, and what is going on, and why are some of the quote-unquote, I guess, black gatekeepers or black quote-unquote leaders, whatever, in her district, what are they doing, and I don't know. I don't know what's going on. I'll just put it that way. Maybe I shouldn't have called in today because I don't know what's going on. Yeah.
Thank you, Leona, for your call. From South Carolina, Khalil, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. How you doing?
Okay. How about you?
I'm good. As usual, you've got me people thinking. And I'm just thinking about history because both of those areas, they have a large Middle Eastern population because of the migration that started in the late 40s, early 50s. So they're people of color, but there are a lot of Middle Eastern folk that they represent. So that's you know, the history of the area, that's one issue. So on the one hand, maybe they are representing the thoughts and feelings of their constituency. But also, you have to look at the money. Who was giving money to their campaign? That's what I don't know, but that's what I think maybe we need to look at, because you know, a lot of times it's about the money and about corruption. But so that's kind of my thought. What do you think about that?
Oh, yes, in every political situation, you naturally look in that direction. Who is supporting you? Who are your troops? What is the articulated agenda, as opposed to an agenda that is a little bit more remote? It's not being articulated, but it's being worked on. And if an agenda has priority over others or other agendas, then some will fall by the wayside. I'm just asking the question, because I'm seeing too many instances in which I simply can't explain, even to myself, what's going on. How are these legislators intending to carry out their duties? What are the priority items? We don't know. The Democratic Party itself doesn't know. So it leaves a lot of room for individuals to craft their own approach. This is a problem. There's no leadership to speak of in the Democratic Party. It's laissez-faire. Do whatever you want to do, as long as you don't frighten the horses. You can do whatever it is you want to do.
Well,
I think it requires some education, meaning that all legislators should in some way find a way to communicate to their constituencies what they're doing. What are their priority items?
Well, you remember Representative Ellis, I think. He was representing one of the two ladies' districts. You know, there's a lot of Middle Eastern, a lot of Muslims in both those districts. But they're different though, because Ms. Omar is different than Tlaib, and I'm not really surprised that they're not building alliances with the Black Caucus, because maybe that really doesn't reflect their district as much as their ancestry. I mean, they're people of color, but you know, they're not like from a different. They're from a different culture.
So what? You know, Adam Clayton Powell was from a totally different culture, but there's no question as to where his interests were. He dedicated his whole life to fighting universal issues. They weren't unique just to Harlem, not at all. I may be mistaken, but the messages, and I've talked about it before, it still exists. It's gotten worse, I think. We have a Democratic Party that is just not communicating well about itself and its membership as to what are the priority items. Oh, the S I just recalled is sanctions.
Oh, okay.
BDS. I forgot it for a moment. So,
well I totally agree with you. And, the DNC is, the DNC is just incredibly weak. You know, we've talked about this before. It's almost as if they're on course to self-destruct. They're not serious. In other words, when they allowed 20-some people to run, you know, it seems like those type of negotiations should have gone on in back rooms and until you figure out how many people are going to be vetted and really make it through the process.
Well, I'm hearing music, which means our program has come to an end. We will connect, of course, tomorrow, and we may continue because I have a long list of topics we ought to get through. So we'll see each other tomorrow, 1 o'clock sharp, as usual. Bye-bye.